You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Fairway, like no other market. Welcome to Why We Cook on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Erica Wides, your host for the evening. And believe it or not, this is episode number 33 of Why We Cook. It's been almost a year. It's almost my one-year anniversary, and that's pretty exciting. It's been a good year. So, a couple weeks back in a show that I did, I don't even remember the theme of the show. For some reason, I escapes me. I was talking about the very few foods that I really, really don't like. The couple of foods that I just don't want to eat. And, I remember. I was talking about blood oranges a few weeks ago. I was talking about the imminent arrival of blood orange season. That's what it was. And that got me on the subject of the foods I don't like, which are orange juice and green bell peppers. The only two foods I claim that I don't like, orange juice and green bell peppers. And I was talking about how in Rome, when I used to live in Rome, you could get glasses of fresh squeezed blood orange juice, and it was so delicious and so great. But how I don't like regular orange juice. And actually, I inspired one of my co-workers here, one of the engineers, Jack, to go out and buy blood orange juice that night after the show. So I'm glad I have that effect on people. But anyway, so yeah, that's what I was talking about. And I know it makes me un-American that I don't like orange juice, but I don't care. And green bell peppers, I just can't stand. I like shishito peppers, which are Japanese, and I like padron peppers, which are from Spain. And both of those are green. But those are really flavorful and really tasty, and you kind of roast them or blister them in hot oil and eat them salted and hot as a little snack, and those are great. But green bell peppers suck. They serve no purpose culinarily whatsoever. They have no flavor. They're harsh. They're acrid. I'm sorry. I don't get it. I'm sorry, New Orleans. I know you love your green peppers, but this Yankee just doesn't get it. Anyway, so I generally, you know, I'd say those are the two foods I don't like. General statement. And I like to say that I'll eat just about anything, you know, at least once. I'll try anything. Even if it has orange juice or green peppers in it, I'll eat it. And since I'm a chef, I'm supposed to really like certain foods. You know, I'm supposed to, like, be very adventurous and say that I like things. And especially the foods that would kind of like induce cringing and fear in more pedestrian amateur eaters, people who don't eat for a living, which chefs cook for a living. But because I teach, really, I eat for a living, which has its highs and lows. I just gave a practical exam yesterday, so I can say for a fact that it has its highs and lows. But I need to have, you know, this certain level of bravado about eating when it comes to the exotic or the creepy in order to maintain my chef credentials, because they kick you out of the secret chef society if you don't have that sort of bravado, if you don't eat that stuff, if you you know, won't drink the shiso flavored Kool-Aid, if you get my reference. And incidentally, speaking of teaching and speaking of the Kool-Aid, that's the kind of cultural reference that I make when I teach that lately just produces a room full of utterly blank stares, because I'm starting to realize that I'm so much older than most of my students that they don't get the Kool-Aid reference. So I know some of my students are listening right now because they told me yesterday they were going to. So for your homework tonight, go onto Google and look up the words Jonestown and Kool-Aid and tell me tomorrow what you find. Anyway, the shiso-flavored Kool-Aid would be what the chefs in the Secret Chef Society drink when they get together to eat all the crazy out there foods that chefs claim that they like. You know, things like offal, all the appendages, the nasty bits, stuff like durian, if you know what durian is, Cambodian shrimp paste, smells really bad, Thai shrimp paste, really bad. And I actually do really like a lot of that stuff. I mean, don't get me wrong. Some of that's really good. But, you know, there are a couple of foods other than orange juice and green peppers that I don't just dislike. I just don't get them. It's sort of the culinary equivalent of art school movies. We were just talking about this in here before when I went to art school, and we would have to go see these films that were supposed to be these masterpieces of avant-garde cinema, and I would fall asleep because I couldn't follow it. I just didn't get it. But I had to, after the film, be like, oh, yeah, that was brilliant. Dark. Anyway, so what is it about, you know, these foods that people claim to love so much? I mean, is it that they really love the food, or is it bravado? Is it a culinary game of truth or dare? Do people really like them? I don't know. I think sometimes they just say they're liking them, like art. Sometimes you just have to pretend you like it or certain bands. So tonight on Why We Cook, I've made a very short list of foods that maybe I just misunderstand. Is it just me? Maybe it's genetic. I don't know. There's a huge genetic component to taste, but I don't come from a line of picky eaters. And I love all things bitter and sour and intensely flavored. So let's just see. We'll go down the list and we'll see. But I also must say that a large part of what it is about these foods is textural. Some of them have perfectly good flavor. It's more the textures that make them seem unfood-like, or they have a flavor that doesn't seem to pair well with their texture, and there's like a frisson there. As we would say in art school, the juxtaposition of the flavor and the texture don't seem to be meshing well for me. So maybe that's a part of it. I don't know. Although I like weird textures too. You know, I love the chewy, love the gummy bears. I've eaten jellyfish. I don't know. So anyway, last month, I was in Korea. I was on my way back from working in Vietnam, and I stopped in Korea, and I tasted what I think was my first abalone. I think. I may have eaten it before at sushi places, but I don't know. I don't think so. It's really expensive here, and I'm somewhat thrifty, so I don't think I would have ever ordered it. If you don't know what abalone is, it's a shellfish. It grows in the Pacific. They have these beautiful curved shells. Almost looks like a mussel shell that kind of curves in on itself. The abalone itself is this kind of weird little critter that I'll get to more about that later on down the line. But abalone was never really eaten much in the U.S. They're just not eaten, except by Japanese immigrants on the West Coast. But there's a lot of them in the Pacific, and fishermen on the West Coast harvest them and then sell them to Asia, to Northern Asia, China, Japan, Korea, and can make a fortune selling abalone to Asia. So I was in Korea, and I went one night to the wholesale fish market in Seoul with my friend Eunice G, who I was visiting there, who incidentally has a cool blog called Pink and Sour, but most of it's in Korean, but it has some good pictures if you want to check it out. I know it sort of sounds like porn, Pink and Sour, but it's Pink N, the letter N, Sour. You should check it out. Anyway, so at this fish market, you can pick out like whole live fish, and then they'll whack them for you and slice them into sashimi. So we picked out a whole flounder from the tank. It was alive. You know, we pointed to the one we wanted, and a couple of odd little shellfishy things that I don't know the name for because I'd never seen them before. And then she said, oh, do you like abalone? And I couldn't really say either way. I couldn't remember if I'd ever had it, but I'd always wanted to try it because I hear people just raving about it. You know, especially Japanese people love it, and everybody says it's so great. So we threw a few of those in, too. I didn't realize how expensive they were. And so at this market, like I was saying, in Seoul, you can buy the fish live, and then the guys who sell the fish to you will kill it, and they'll clean it, like at a regular fish market. But then they also expertly slice it up into sashimi on the spot, which I think is so cool that these guys are fishmongers and sashimi chefs. It's a dual career. And then after you make your fish purchase, you walk out of the building across this huge, dark, freezing cold, icy parking lot, because it was January, into a very kind of dumpy, nondescript building, and you go up some stairs and you sit down in what looks like a diner, like sort of very low-end diner luncheonette. And you sit down, and of course it's Korea, so they bring out, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 little bowls of banchan, the little great side dishes, and condiments and ginger and shredded daikon and lettuce and all kinds of stuff. And then out comes your fish, beautifully sliced up into sashimi. A couple minutes ago, it was flopping around the tank. Now it's laid out on your plate, ready for you to eat. So the flounder was sliced up, and the bones get cooked into soup, and they make this great soup that you then eat at the end of the meal. And it was a fantastic food experience overall. It was great. We had soju, which is like Korean sake, and, you know, had a great old time. And the abalone was also sliced up and served along with the fish. And also there were some little weird shellfish things that I have to say, honestly, when they were in their shell, they looked sort of like hard brown poop. I don't know the name. If anybody knows what that is, call the show. Let me know. But when they took them out of the shell, they were even worse, because then they looked almost obscene. I didn't really like those. Neither did she. But anyway, back to the abalone. So the flavor of it was good. It was crisp. It was briny. It was kind of cucumbery. You know, had that nice flavor of the ocean. But the texture was like crisp. It had like a audible crunch to it. And when I eat shellfish, I sort of expect like a pliant suppleness to it with a little bit of chew, but not a snap. And that kind of threw me off a little bit. So I know that people love abalone. I know it's a huge delicacy. I know people go crazy for it and they pay a lot of money for it. But and it's one of those chefy things that I'm supposed to say, oh yeah, I had abalone in Korea. It was amazing. It was so good. But frankly, I just didn't get it. Maybe I'm somewhat pedestrian in my taste after all. I don't know. But abalone would be on that list. Okay, so it's out. So the confessional begins. We have to take a short break. When we come back, more foods that I'm supposed to love but don't. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Fairway, like no other market. I was actually just there today, Fairway. It was a great experience. Anyway, you're listening to Why We Cook on heritageradionetwork.com. Remember that you can listen to this show every Tuesday night live at 6:30 p.m. on heritageradionetwork.com. And you can also listen to any show that airs on Heritage Radio Network anytime, archived on the website, heritageradionetwork.com. You can also listen to live streaming 24 hours a day now. And if that's not enough, you can also podcast any one of our hundreds of shows on iTunes now. So there's no excuse for not listening to any of your favorite shows. And if you're a fan of Why We Cook, I would like to invite you to join me on Facebook. Just go to Facebook, type in Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network, and the fan page comes up, and I would love to hear from you. Become a fan. Let me know what you think. Or, if that's not enough, you can go to the Heritage Radio Network website and leave a comment on my show page. And people have been leaving comments, and that's great. I love to hear them, so keep it up, please. Okay, so tonight we're talking about the foods that, as a professional chef, I'm supposed to love and speak rapturously about, but really, in secret, I don't actually like them. And of course, now the secret is out. This is the big confessional night. So we were talking about abalone in the previous segment, which is this, you know, supreme delicacy for people in Japan and Korea and China and other places, but it didn't work for me. I don't want my shellfish to crunch when it's raw. It was too incongruous. I don't know. I'll work on it. I'll try. But it's so expensive anyway. What's the point, really, right? For the price of one abalone, I could eat like 600 clams, or oysters, and they're local, and that's better. So since we're talking shellfish, I'm going to fess right up and admit something. And this may really be the final straw that gets me kicked out of the secret chef's union forever. And that is that I don't really love uni. you know, sea urchin. I've had it quite a few times. I like the flavor, sort of, if it's really fresh. But I don't know. I don't know. I think I just don't get it yet again. Maybe I have some sort of form of culinary brain damage, but I don't get the uni. I like the flavor, like I said. But maybe it's a textural thing. I don't know. I mean, I love the way they look in the shell. They're beautiful, sea urchins in their shell. And when I'm scuba diving or snorkeling and I see them clinging there on the reefs, my first thought is, you're very pretty and you look very tasty to me because I know what's inside of you. But I think maybe that's just like chef programming, like I'm supposed to think they're tasty. I don't know. I've yet to have the kind of transcendent uni experience that people talk about, or maybe they're making it up. But I know that some people, I think, get kind of freaked out about uni because what you're eating when you're eating uni is not actually like their meat. It's their gonads. It's their sex organs. Some people probably get kind of a thrill out of that. You're eating their ovaries, really. Maybe that's why people really like them. But, you know, they can be really expensive, uni. They can cost up to $450 a kilo. Kilo, 2.2 pounds. That's a lot of money. And, you know, the Japanese, of course, love the uni. And I was reading about uni before I came here to do the show. And it actually said that in the Orkney Islands, which are these tiny little islands off the northern coast of Scotland, where I've actually been to, very remote. There's not much there. A lot of sheep and some scotch. But in the Orkney Islands, they were once used as a substitute for butter because they're rich and creamy and sort of spreadable, which seems very odd to me. But I suppose during wartime or shortages or something, if there was no butter, you could use your uni instead. Makes sense. They're very rich. They have a lot of fat. I don't know. When I was in Orkney, all I ate was fish and chips and cake because I was a semi-vegetarian at the time, and they eat a lot of meat. They eat a lot of haggis and a lot of bad meat. And I was trying not to eat any meat, so all I ate was fish and chips and cake, and I got really fat. Anyway, I'm digressing. So I'd really love to say, oh, I love uni, like when I go out for sushi and everyone goes, ooh, uni, so good. And I don't want to be the odd kid out in the club, but I think I'll have to give it another chance. I'm going to have to seek out the best uni I can in New York, and I'll try it, and I'll report back to you. Maybe I'm just not mature enough. Maybe I need to grow up a little bit. You know, sometimes you mature into tastes, even though I am middle-aged now. Maybe it's just a matter of time. There are things you develop a taste for. I didn't like beer until I was 30. So maybe I'll grow up and learn to love it. However, since we're on the subject of Japan and Japanese food, I will not, however, be giving natto another chance. Natto is number 3 on the list. If you are unfamiliar with this so-called food called natto, it's a Japanese breakfast staple made of soybeans and salt. Now, that sounds innocuous enough, but the soybeans are inoculated with a mold, and it makes them ferment. Still, not a problem. There are plenty of other fermented salty soy foods that I love and relish, like miso and soy sauce, all fermented soy foods with salt. But natto is a whole other world, a whole other ball of wax. It has this extreme smell that's almost ammoniated, and also very strong cheesy overtones. Now, what's interesting is I love very strong cheese, and some of the best cheeses actually have ammoniacal overtones. But that's okay in a cheese, not in a soy product. But that's also funny about the cheesiness, because a lot of Asians in Asian cultures find the smell of cheese repulsive. They don't like the strong smell of very pungent cheeses, but they love the smell of natto. I find the smell of natto so repulsive that even just sitting here talking about it, I'm getting kind of queasy. And I may have to take a little break. But it also has this texture it's like stringy and sticky. It's whole soybeans in this sticky goo. And the more you mix it, the stringier it gets. And it develops like this web of like sticky goop. It's very snot-like, I must say. And I know people love it, and I'm sorry. I don't mean to offend any Japanese people out there who love their natto, but as a, you know, raised in New York Jew, it was not in my early food experience. So it has this, anyway, this crazy sticky texture, and you usually eat it for breakfast in Japan, and they'll garnish it with things like, you know, strong mustard or wasabi, grated wasabi root, or daikon, or scallions, or it's eaten over rice, or, deliciously enough, a raw egg. It's not bad enough that you eat the natto, but then you have the pleasure of a slippery raw egg white gliding down your throat, gagging you. So it's just not for me. And sadly, though, it's apparently extremely nutritious natto. It's like a miracle food. And, you know, I'm all about those. I like the fermented foods I've talked about, miso and tofu and sauerkraut and all that stuff on here. And I love all of that. And I wish I could do it, because it's supposedly this like preventative of all sorts of terrible diseases. Maybe Alzheimer's even. They think it has something in it that could prevent Alzheimer's. And it's even supposed to reverse baldness in men. And you know the expression, you know, you eat something, it'll grow hair on your chest. Well, I think natto is so bad, it makes hair grow on your head. I don't know. And again, and I'm sorry to all my Japanese friends and any Japanese listeners, this is nothing personal. Please don't be offended. I think natto is like Vegemite, you know, or Marmite, if you know what that stuff is, the Australian, New Zealand, British breakfast treat made from fermented brewer's yeast, that it comes in a little jar and it looks like tar and smells like terrible, and they eat it spread on toast. And if you grow up with it, you love it. It's one of those things that you need to eat every day of your life and really appreciate. An acquired taste, as they say. So that's the natto. And then, of course, while we're, I feel so bad because it's another Japanese product that I want to bring up. And I love Japanese food, and I love Japan and Japanese people and everything. And I feel so bad, but we're being honest tonight. So I know it's completely unhip and peasant-like of me to say this, but I don't actually love shiso either. Shiso is an herb. It's a green leaf. Sometimes it's called the beefsteak plant. It's these sort of big green leaves that you may have eaten with sushi. And to me, it has this very like soapy metallic flavor that, which is sometimes how people describe cilantro. But I love cilantro. I could eat cilantro as a salad. But shiso like does something. It's I can't eat it. I've tried because I know I'm supposed to like it, because every other chef goes, oh my God, I love shiso so much. But oddly enough, when I was in Korea, they also eat shiso there. And whenever you get Korean barbecue or, you know, meat, they'll serve you a pile of lettuce leaves and a pile of these other leaves that my friend was calling wild sesame leaves. And they tasted really good, and I loved them. And when I came home, I looked up the two different leaves, the shiso and the wild sesame, and it turns out that they're related. They're both perillas, perilla, but the Korean one tastes a lot different to me, and the Japanese one I just can't do. So it's interesting. They're just these two subtly different varieties of the same plant, but one of them I really like, and one of them I don't. I like it so much that I've actually ordered some seeds, some wild sesame slash perilla slash Korean shiso seeds for my garden this year. So I don't know, maybe I was Korean in a past life. Anyway, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, a little more about these foods. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Fairway, like no other market. So welcome back to Why We Cook. I'm Erica Wides, your host, by the way. And I'm an instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education. I may not have mentioned that in a while, but That's who I am. If you like what you hear on the show, please leave a comment on the Why We Cook page on heritageradionetwork.com. Let me know what you think. So tonight I've been talking about all those foods that as a chef I'm supposed to love and revere, but really in secret I don't like them, and now the secret is out. And I've mostly been talking about Asia. So now we're going to kind of move back to Europe, back to my roots, and talk about France, Italy, Spain, you know, the kind of the birthplace of European cuisine. And talk like about offal, and organs and all the other little scrappy bits. Now, as a chef, I am all about thriftiness, and I can really appreciate the whole animal approach to eating, you know, nose to tail, making charcuterie, salami, all of that stuff. The French do it, the Italians do it, the Spanish do it, the Germans do it, everybody does it. And all of that stuff is great. It all tastes really good. But a lot of those bits are a lot better when you grind them up, mix them with a lot of spices, and stuff them into a casing and eat them as a sausage or as a salami. Some of those bits on their own, they're not so good. And what I'm talking about are the things like the kidneys and the sweetbreads, which is the thymus gland of the animal, or the brains. I know people love them, and there's certainly a whole school of classical cooking that utilizes them. And when I teach about them, I have to pretend to love them. See, now I'll never be able to show my face at work again, because when we do sweetbreads, I'm going to say, oh, they're great, they're great. And actually, sweetbreads aren't so bad. I like them. They're sort of creamy and sweet and delicate and kind of nice. Although I would probably never order them if they were on a menu, but I do appreciate them. And actually, here at Roberta's, where Heritage Radio is located, they often do some nice organy type things on the menu, and I can appreciate that too, because they're using really good meats, really good animals, utilizing the whole thing. But you know, in the past, when the cost of producing a full-grown animal was big, you of course wanted to be very economical, and you wanted to use up every little bit. And then as our meat production got cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, those parts of the animal became less and less popular, and then those parts of the animals became associated with poor people. Eating organ meats and pig's feet and things like that were what you did if you were poor, because you couldn't afford the good cuts of meat. That's where the expression eating high on the hog comes from, because the more money you had, the higher up on the hog you could eat. You could eat the ham and the loin and the chops, and you didn't have to eat like the feet and the tail and the nasty bits. You know, so as meat got cheaper and people got more affluent, people ate higher and higher on the hog and left all that stuff behind. Now there's a huge revived interest in all things scrappy and odd. And that's great too. I love that. I love that people are doing it. I just am not a huge fan of sitting down to eat one entire organ on a plate. I have no problem with chopping it up and mixing it with other things and getting various flavors and textures. It's the whole like single organ part that I don't love. I'll eat a sweetbread. Kidneys, kidneys are there to filter out the pee. You know, I used to work with this guy up in Maine. I worked in Maine for a while, and he was a real Mainer. He was a local Mainer. And he used to say, I could never eat liver because it's like eating the oil filter out of the car. And I used to think, oh, you're such a peasant. But you know what? He's kind of right. I like bird livers, chicken liver, duck liver, all that. It's good stuff. Foie gras, delicious. I'm not so big on the calf's liver. The steer liver, it is like a little like eating an oil filter out of a car. I know, as a chef, yet again, I'm supposed to love all of it, but I just don't. However, now that we're eating better meat again, heirloom breeds, well-raised animals, I'm going to give it another try. Part of why I used to avoid organ meats was because animals were fed such garbage that all that garbage accumulates in their organs, and I didn't want to do it. Now, with happy, healthy heirloom varieties of animals being raised, I'm sure their organs are much healthier and much better. So maybe that's going to open up a whole new chapter in organ meat eating for me. On an intellectual chef thinking level, I get it and I want to like them. And I think now that I feel better about the animals, I'll be able to do it. But not if it's like an oil filter out of a car, like Matt Shea used to say up in Maine. Anyway, we're just about out of time. So thank you for listening tonight to Why We Cook, episode number 33, if you can believe it. And we'll see you next Tuesday night at 6:30. Have a good night.